hello, friends and folks, and welcome to Scanline Media's 2021 Gimmick Awards. We're here to talk about our experiences with games and other media in 2021 and celebrate the best of them. I'm Six Step Mark.
I'm Jennifer Uncle.
I'm Kyrie Page.
And for this one, we're talking about the best moment presented by Final Fantasy XIV Endwalker, because Final Fantasy XIV Endwalker is too... So in a minute here, we're going to list all the games that are on this list before talking about their moments, because this is going to be spoilery. And so the games that we mention are most likely going to get spoiled. Go ahead.
Some of these moments are going to be more mechanical in nature, but some of these are actual, like, story moments that, like, radically redefine, like, the game in question.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, keep that in mind, because, yeah. But we will be spoiling a few moments from these games. Not to the degree I think it would completely ruin the experience of playing them, but still, if you're sensitive to that stuff, you know,
yeah.
Listener, beware.
And that's why it's presented by Final Fantasy XIV Endwalker, is because, like, it's one thing to ruin, to spoil, like, for example, we're going to spoil some things from Resident Evil Village, right?
Mm-hmm.
That game is, like, what, like, a dozen hours or something?
Yeah, you can beat that in a dedicated afternoon.
If you're spoiling stuff from Final Fantasy XIV Endwalker, that's, like, I don't know. I feel like for a normal person, if you're real good at this, that's 100 hours or something. Like, if you're very efficient. Like, it's just too much to spoil that for people. That's not fair. Mm-hmm. And so it makes me sad there's stuff from that I can't talk about, because there's some very cool stuff, but... I just, you know, just common decency says we should leave it out.
Yeah,
don't worry, Endwalker, you're gonna get some respect.
Yeah, it's like little over half an Umineko in terms of length. That's a long time.
Jen, do you want to read us the games that we will be potentially spoiling on this podcast?
Sure thing. So we have Monster Hunter Rise, Jackbox Party Pack 8, which is really funny to talk about in terms of spoilers. There's Melty Blood Type Lumina. There's Resident Evil Village. Sorry, I got distracted because Six is
just
editing things.
Just say it.
Okay, Melty Blood Type Lumina. There's Resident Evil Village. Metroid Dread. Mobile Suit Gundam Battle Operation 2 Code Fairy. Hitman 3. Adios. Inscription. Hell Let Loose. Near Replicant, and Overboard, with an exclamation mark.
I mean, that's the title of the game.
Yeah.
You know. Yep. So this is the moment where you fucking pull the ripcord and get out of here, because from here on out, spoiler town, baby.
You best start believing in spoilers.
Yep.
They help cars stay close to the road when they're driving really fast.
Really?
It's like a wing thing, but like the other way, so it pushes the car down.
Thank you, Captain Barbosa. Now I know what to look for when I buy a new, like, sports car.
Listen, you lady, you can't afford a car that goes fast enough to need a spoiler. Don't fucking delude yourself.
Aw. Well, I can dream.
No, I won't allow it. No dreams.
Jen, why don't you list the best moments as presented by Final Fantasy XIV Endwalker?
Okay. There's taking on arena fights with friends or turf wars in Monster Hunter Rise. There's the sense of bewilderment of rankings of pointless things in Pull Mine, Jackbox Party Pack 8, shield rallies in Melty Blood Type Lumina, the baby sequence or giving Lady Dimitrescu a hand in Resident Evil Village, that cool super suit, or Samus says we're done here in Metroid Dread, Titania, Queen of Fairies, in Gundam Code Fairy. Berlin, in Hitman 3. Getting Your Affairs in Order, in Adios. Replacing Your Eye, in Inscription. Crewing a Tank, in Hell Let Loose. Going Back and Addressing the Story. Or Wait, That Was New, in Near Replicant. And Oh Look, Dolphins, in Overboard.
All right, I got a quick cut for you. This is, like, a very personal thing, and this was just a lot of fun when it happened. The sense of bewilderment is very specific to a group of friends that I have in which whenever we play the Pull Mine at Jackbox Party Pack 8, it really reveals some, like, not disturbing things, just more like, wait, really? You ranked it in that way? Like, Pull Mine as a game is only really conducive when you have, like, a large group of people to pull and to, like, figure out certain trends. And it's also the game you learn where somebody thinks the best place to put a roller coaster would be through, like, really, really old redwood forests.
It's... I think the best joy I got out of Pull Mine was from Jen. Thank you, Jen. Because the one time I played a decent chunk of it was Jen was on the opposite team. And I feel like it worked out such that the teams were all the people who talk Jen down from the cliff on one side, and then Jen and people who are too polite to say no to Jen on the other team.
Uh-huh.
And so it's Jen being like, fiercest animal. I feel like penguin, right, guys? It's a penguin? And everyone on their team is like, Jen, what are you doing? But we won't say it because we're on the other team. And then the people on Jen's team are like, sure, Jen.
Sure.
Penguin's real fierce.
Exactly. It's like, what? Because of the way the game works is whenever, depending on which team you're on, like it trades back and forth. And one person on the team, like, is the one making the choice. So in some ways, like in an even group, sometimes the person who's actually pressing the button has the most power, but whatever. But it's like, sometimes the suggestions that come out of people's mouths, like in this game, is truly like magical nonsense.
Did I really say that a penguin is one of the fiercest animals?
Listen, I didn't want to cite anything real. I didn't want to do it to you like that. That was a theoretical example.
Okay, cool.
It's just, I mean, like, it could go. It's a fun mechanical moment. It's not particularly deep, but it is really fun to be with a group of friends that you thought, like, had some sense, and then you realize, like, oh, wait a minute, this is what they think? Okay. It's a fun little game. It's not the best one of the party pack, but I felt like that was conducive to, like, the most, like, absurd arguments and just, you know, back and forths in that game. So I wanted to shout it out.
I have a question. Is Turf Wars the thing where it's like the tower defense where you're...
No.
Okay, good.
Turf War, that's awful. Okay, let me talk about Monster Hunter Rise real quick. I think in terms of moments, like, I think, like, Six, correct me if I'm wrong, but Turf Wars haven't been a thing in, like, Monster Hunter before, correct?
They have. They're in World.
They are
introduced in World.
Okay. Well, I just thought
and
it was really fun.
To be honest, they're better in World, but...
Sure. Granted, I put this on this list because, like, yeah, I found Monster Hunter Rise, like, really mechanically fun and interesting this year. You know, going down arena fights with friends, that was awesome. Like, I love doing that stream with y'all and Alan, where we were just coordinating trying to take on a Magna Mallow, and then the stream broke halfway through and Jen had to, like, quickly fix it. Like, there's a certain controlled chaos, but I imagine, like, I mean, this is Monster Hunter's bread and butter. Like, this is nothing new to Monster Hunter. And same with, like, Turf Wars. I just found them really spectacular. It was really great to see a fucking, again, Magna Mallow, like, leap hundreds of feet into the air and just rip apart, like, another monster and they slam back into the ground. It really added to this level of ferocity and, like, it really added to the spectacle of hunting these monsters. And, I think, like, those two moments stuck out to me in Rise, and maybe they stuck out to me because it was my first, you know, real Monster Hunter that I really invested time into. But damn, it's just cool to see these giant monsters fucking each other up in the world, and you take advantage of that. Actually, no, if I could add one quick thing for Monster Hunter Rise right now, it would be when you ride the monster. Again, I don't know if this is going to win, but it is really cool to set up situations where you you like knock them out temporarily and then just ride on the back of them and just command them to slam into the other monster and really go to town. Like, rare materials drop, everybody gets to pick them up, and then you get to take control of the fight for just a brief moment. Like, it's a really great, like, thing to see, like, one of your members of your party leap onto the back onto this monster and just control them for a few seconds, because it helps for the pacing of the fight, I think, because Monster Hunter fights can be long and protracted, but the ability to ride them and take control away from the monster, even for a brief moment, like, is part of the power trip that is hunting, like, monster hunting.
Uh-huh.
So I think the strongest moment of the three is monster riding, but if I'm the only person who was really into Monster Hunter Rise this year, I could see them going. But I really, like, it's always cool to see your character jump on the back of these monsters and, like, go to town.
Yeah, for me, I guess my biggest problem is most of these moments, I feel like, I mean, I would honestly, if I kept any of them, I would keep the arena fights, because that feels like, you know, a distinct moment I had this year. Well, last year. But the rest of it is just, like, stuff that I feel like I experienced before and I think better in other Monster Hunter games.
Yeah, the way that you've talked about World really makes me want to, like, pick it up on PS4, Steam, or whatever, wherever you're playing it, and do some dual hunts with you, because it seems neat.
I think because our friend Alan is playing on Steam, if we actually end up taking the plunge, we'll probably do it on
Steam. PC, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, in that case, we can go ahead and just cut the moments for Monster Hunter Rise, but, you know, on this list, I value, like, interesting mechanical moments here, and I wanted to kind of shout that out. But yeah, go ahead, you know, I will fight for Monster Hunter Rise in another category, so it's fine. Where do we go from here?
We can cut Replacing Your Eye in Inscription. There are a lot of cool moments in Inscription, and I think part of the problem is that Inscription, like, I picked Replacing Your Eye because that was a standout moment, but I think Inscription is just an experience you kind of have to take as a whole, really. Boiling it down to any one moment is difficult because it's such a ride. But so in Inscription, you take... So they introduced the idea that when you take damage in this card game you're playing against this creepy dude, it adds, like, golden teeth to a little scale, and when one side gets too weighed down, it loses, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they introduce a pair of pliers as an item you can get, and you're like, I see. I can pull out a tooth and add it to the scale to sort of, like, to alter the balance, right?
That's okay.
Yeah.
And then they introduce a dagger, and you're like, uh-huh? What does this do? And I legitimately didn't know, because it's just like you click on an item and you confirm that you want to use it, and it gets used. And, like, there's a pair of scissors you can use to just destroy a card on the field, and there's stuff like that. And I was like, oh, maybe the dagger does something like that. And then my character lifts up, it's a first-person game, like, lifts up the dagger and just starts stabbing it into the screen. And I'm like, oh, God, oh, God, oh, God. And, yeah, you pluck out your own eye and drop it on the scale. And then your screen, like, your vision is fucked up because you just cut out your own eye. And then if you manage to win that round, like that encounter, as it were, because it's one of these, you know, like roguelike deck builders where it's multiple encounters in a run, the creepy dude is like, listen, you're not the first person. This happens. And this game is really not very fun if you can't see. And so he just pulls out a box full of eyes and is like, just pop a new one in there. And... you can do this multiple times. This happens in multiple runs, and, like, there's, like, you know, various just eyes. There are, like, some glass eyes. There's some, like, a weird, like, wooden eye. And then there's one that looks, like, fucking strange. It looks like a rock with weird sigils on it, right? And if you pick that one and pop it in, suddenly you can see more shit. And that's all I will say, but you can see more things.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like this is the ringing endorsement to, like, go fucking play Inscription.
Yeah. Inscription's so fucking good!
It's something I definitely want to play more of this year.
I think I have it installed. I just need to, like, take the plunge and play it.
I feel like I talked myself into wanting to keep replacing your eye on this list.
I think it can stay for now. I think we can put a pin in it. It doesn't have to be cut right now, but let's go through a couple of these other moments before we move on, I think.
All right, we can cut. Okay, this time we really can cut crewing a tank in Hell Let Loose. This is a great experience that just sort of summarizes what Hell Let Loose is like, where when you want to be part of the crew of a tank, right, in this game, first of all, you cannot do it alone. There are three positions, and they're not all necessary, but boy, it really helps to have them. There is, like, a tank commander who's poking their head out the top and has binoculars, right? There is a gunner who controls the turret and has a really small, like, window of view, and also a slow turn rate on the turret, which is why you want the tank commander so you can actually see shit. You only want to be looking at what you're about to shoot. And then there's the driver. And here are the things that complicate every part of this. Driver can see almost nothing. Can just see straight ahead and cannot turn their view. Tank commander is looking around, but that's all they can do. Gunner has to manually load in the next shell. Tank driver has to manually change gears. It's a stick shift.
Oh boy.
And you can imagine how this goes wrong.
Like coordinating one thing between three people is enough of a challenge, but it sounds like there's a certain level of, like, chaos in crewing a tank in this game that just leads to, like, petty bickering and, like, just moments of, like, I'm trying to turn! And, like, the stick shift's stuck! It's like,
We had a great experience. Nick and I did it without a tank commander. It was just the two of us. And ultimately, I don't think that was our downfall. But we got into a duel with another tank, and it was like, you know, like, I was driving and I was doing the gear shifting and just I was switching directions and back and forth and turning and dodging all these shots and weaving through the battlefield, and Nick was loading and firing, and every time you fire, there's a huge plume of smoke and you can't see shit either where from your end, because there's smoke from the barrel, and from where it hits, there's a bunch of smoke and debris where the shell lands. And it's like, oh man, that was an intense duel, but finally we got destroyed. And there's a beat, and Nick's like, I don't think we hit them a single time. Hell Let Loose is good.
Yeah.
But we could cut it.
Yeah. I could also bring one up to cut relatively quickly. It's getting your affairs in order in Adios. Adios, for those who don't know, is a game about a Kansas pig farmer who works with the mafia to dispose of dead bodies. And he has made a decision to... basically, he wants out. And so a hitman visits his farm, and basically most of the game is having a conversation with this, like, mafia guy to just, like, learning about the pig farmer's life and his relationship to, like, other people and things like that. So it's a very exact kind of game. But then the hitman basically leaves and says, like, okay, you need to get your shit in order, because tomorrow, like, come hell or high water, you need to make a decision. And the main character, the pig farmer in this game, basically has to choose between experiencing, like, a physical death, because, like, the hitman has made no bone, made it very clear that he will kill you if you decide to try and get out, Or he will experience some kind of spiritual death where he decides to compromise on his morals and continue doing this awful thing. And this moment is like, you're just by yourself on the farm and you try to like cook yourself a meal. And you can mess up the meal and it can reflect like you, the player, and also the like character's emotional state. There are two particular moments during this sequence that are like stand out to me in which you can call like your neighbor and say, hey, I need someone to look after my animals for an unspecified reason. And the neighbor is like really nice. You get the sense that they've, you know, been to each other's farms to like, you know, borrow supplies or just talk because, you know, you're on big farmland in the middle of Kansas. There's not many people around. And it's like one of his very few human connections. And you get the sense from the voice acting that the pig farmer is like just struggling to be like, I want to make this human connection, but he just cannot be honest and say, oh, I'm doing this horrible thing. And you can try and contact your son. And the son is basically like, Dad, you've been out of my life for years. Like, what you're doing is basically like too little too late, and there's a tragedy there. And I don't know, it was really affecting to just like go through this moment and reflect on like that experience. And also, you know, there's that moment of choice basically through the gameplay, through the mechanics of, again, will the pig farmer experience a physical death or a spiritual death? And I think that's interesting. I think that, like, while Adios isn't much of a game, it's not one to be mastered, but it's, you know, it's a game to be, like, to experience a story. And I think it was interesting. Sucks that the author is, like, a huge asshole, but, I don't know, the story's okay.
Yeah, sounds like maybe watching an LP of is a good idea.
Yeah, yeah. Watch an LP or watch a friend play through it. That's what I did, and it was affecting, but yeah. But, you know, that is kind of like, I mean, there are lots of games about like people reflecting on their lives nowadays, which is not a bad thing. I like it when games can be character pieces and introspective and interesting in that way. But I just kind of wanted to shout out that moment.
Okay.
So it's up to you whether this is a point in its favor or a point against it, but, knowing that the baby sequence existed made me stop playing Resident Evil Village.
I thought you got around that eventually.
Nope.
Aw, okay.
I stopped right before it. I may never pick that game back up.
That's a shame, because it's a really good game, and, like,
I was having a good time, and then they were like, hey, we're gonna have this extended horror sequence in a basement with a, you know, gross baby, and it's gonna be some, like, a style of horror that the rest of this game is not, and it's like, yeah, it's because I don't play those games.
Yeah, so one thing I will mention about that is they telegraph each appearance incredibly clearly. Like, each time it happens, you more or less know what's gonna happen, so you can get to the space and time and just wait it out. Like, you're not dealing with a roving AI, except in, like, one room at some point, but...
But, okay. But let's talk a little bit about... So, the baby sequence in RE8 is, like you said, it is, like, you go to this house, all your weapons have been taken away, and you're stuck in this basement, and you're just trying to escape from this basement, and you're solving puzzles and you're going about it, and then and then you look down a dark hallway and a big fucked up baby monster is at the end of it and it is chasing you. I think that the baby sequence is easily, like, you're right, it is not in the style of horror that is like the rest of RE Village. Like, RE Village for most of the game, like, is basically like Evil Dead 2. It's campy, it's goofy, the characters are all over the top weirdos, and, like, you're just kind of, like, going through bizarre situations. But the baby sequence is a deeply, deeply scary moment. Because, you know, it's a very simple in execution moment. It's like, oh, it's the big fucked up monster and it's coming after you and you have very few routes of escape. But I think it is successful because, like, it is, like, kind of in some ways, like, you couldn't build an entire game around, like, the baby sequence. Like, it would get either too old or it would just be so freaky that you couldn't, like, get through it. I think the point in the baby sequence's favor is that it's kind of Resident Evil. Like, the designers for RE8 being like, okay, we're kind of doing this, like, campy horror thing most of the game, but is just trying to remind you, like, no, we can scare the pants off you when we want to. And I think it works on multiple levels. I think even if you're the type of person who just sort of fucks around in that sequence, like, it's very easy to, like, get around. But again, it is, like, super tense. And, like, when I was watching that moment, I was on the edge of my seat. But also, you know, if you watch replays of, like, streamers getting scared at it, it's hilarious because, like, there's one of my favorite Peekaboo moments from 2021 was her dealing with that stupid baby. And she just goes, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, over and over.
Yeah, but those parts of it are definitely strong. But, like, that's one style of Resident Evil. But the other thing on this list, giving Lady Domitrescu a hand, like, that to me is...
That's what I come for. that's what I want for Resident Evil.
That's Resident Evil at its campy best. Like,
yeah.
That sequence is like you're basically running around in the basement trying to open this door while Lady Dimitrescu is chasing you, and you put your hand on a handle for a door, and suddenly you just see the hand and the sleeve like slide the fuck off because she used one of her long monster fingers to cut it off. And then, after that, you have to basically pick up the hand and navigate this maze-like room around you to juke her for long enough that you can get back to that door and open it and take an elevator. And while you're on that elevator, Ethan takes his stump of hand, like, pours some of the first aid juice that's become a thing since Resident Evil 7, like, on the stump, puts the hand there, and just... puts everything back, sleeve and all, and it's such an amazing Evil Dead-ass moment.
And Ethan...
It's so stupid.
And Ethan makes, like, a snide comment, like, after that, just like, huh, like, didn't think that'd work, or something like that. It is incredibly stupid. I think...
He just, like, he takes this, like, cleanly severed wrist, and he puts some antibacterial hand gel on it, and then slaps his severed hand on top of it, and then flexes the fingers. It's like, oh, okay, great. That's so stupid.
I think, honestly, of the two moments, I think we have a little bit, like, stronger feelings of, like, the hand sequence rather than the baby sequence. I think the BB sequence is, like, really well-tuned. I think it is a really incredible moment of, like, just sheer terror, and it works. But it is incongruous with, like, the tone of RE8, and the hand sequence kind of fits that tone better, but is just as memorable. It's stupid, but in a way that is, like... Oh, right, Resident Evil is kind of stupid to begin with.
Well, that's been its shining ethos for, like, since the beginning. It has always been a mix of genuinely terrifying moments and moments that, like, fit right in with a B-tier or Z-tier horror movie. And
yeah,
like, I love it. I love that about Resident Evil. It can be both.
Yeah, like, sometimes it's Sam Raimi and sometimes it's Rob Zombie, you know, like, it's
mm-hmm.
It's like it contains magnitudes, but I think it seems like I'm not ready to cut the hand quite yet, but we can see the baby sequence go.
Yeah, one thing I just want to mention before we leave the hand sequence, you're familiar with how the game ends, right, Six?
Yes.
Okay. I can't so they tell.
They do actually justify it.
Yeah, I can't tell whether them justifying it makes it better or worse. Like,
I think I
the justification is so there are so many layers to how funny and stupid the justification is. I think it stands alone and also is still great.
Yeah, I guess you can also imagine the person explaining this to him being like, yeah, well, you thought you were normal? You did that to your hand and you still thought you were normal?
I explained this stuff to my sister Emily on the phone because she was like, hey, I saw the little bit of the beginning of Resident Evil Village and I didn't really care. But, like, people seem to be, so, like, why don't you just tell me the whole thing? And explaining how that makes sense was, I can't put that on my best moment, but <It's> pretty... explaining how that works, why it actually makes sense that he was able to slap his hand back on is amazing.
Yeah, I think giving Lady Dimitrescu a hand, I think we should put a pin in that as well. I think that's a strong contender.
I can see Oh Look Dolphins from Overboard go. It's great, but so the main character of Overboard, Veronica, has an obsession with dolphins for some complicated reasons, but ultimately when she kills her husband and sets the events of the game in motion, they're up on the top of this cruise ship they're on. And they're all over by the railing, and she says, oh, look, dolphins. And he leans over to look at them, and she shoves him over. And that's good. But the best thing is, then you could kill, like, four more people with that. You could go up and, like, you could be like, hey, let's have a conversation on the deck. And the conversation goes bad, like, you're an evil, murderous bitch, and I don't trust you. And you're like, I'm sorry you feel that. Oh, look, dolphins. And then you shove them over. And then, like, you could even get someone who watched you do that. Come up, they watch you just, you know, say something and then shove someone overboard, and this old lady walks up to you and is like, wow, I didn't think you had it in you. Well, you know, there's you're gonna have to really I don't know, maybe this is gonna cost you in the long run, this knowledge. And you're like, wow, I'm sorry to hear that. Oh, look, dolphins. And the lady's like, wait, there are dolphins? And then you shove her over and she's like, you bitch.
That's
so funny.
That's pretty funny.
I think it is not the tier of experience that is going to make it to the top here, but it is funny and good.
It's one of those things where it's like I think we talked about it in another category. It's a moment. It sounds like it's funny at first, then it's not funny, and then it becomes funny again. Like,
yeah,
it's one of those types of gags.
Okay, so here's a thing. Jen.
Yeah.
Your two moments from Nier, unless you only phrased them vaguely, seem too vague to even be moments to me.
Okay. Yeah, I'll go ahead and explain each one. Starting with Wait, That Was New. Because basically, it wasn't a long time ago between playing Nier on the PS3 and the new Nier Replicant. Like, that wasn't a huge span of time for me. And, like, I knew there was going to be new stuff in this new version of Nier Replicant, just because that's what they've been marketing with. And a bunch of the reviews mentioned, hey, keep playing after the game ends, trust me. But, so I went ahead and I started playing for a while. I was like, huh, I know that they re-recorded all of this and they gave it another pass for localization, but, like, this could just be the same game, and I wouldn't know, just because it's that close. And eventually, you kind of meet a couple, and I was like, oh, okay, I guess I missed this couple earlier because it must have been a side quest I just didn't do. And one of the two members of that couple becomes, like, the person who handles the boat, and it's like, I don't remember the boatman being this talkative, but probably just forgot about that. And I kept going, and I kept going. And then eventually the boatman disappeared, and I got a quest about the boatman disappearing like 5 or 6 hours into the game, and suddenly it was like, oh, this whole chain of events was new, and I had no idea. That's how good of a job they did, like, not only doing fantastic localization and writing here, but also, like, it's not just a high quality, it's just so close to the original tone of that 360 and PS3 game that I had no clue until things took a hard left turn in the story that I didn't recognize before.
I mean, I feel like that's why, I mean, I know the order these are coming out in, so I can say this. I feel like that's why we gave it the win and welcome back. I don't feel like it qualifies as much as a moment to me. I don't know if you agree, Kyrie.
I think it is, like, less of a moment and more of, like, something that colors the experience of it. Because there are games that attempt to do this and do it poorly, I believe. Jen, you were playing, like, the special edition of Tales of Vesperia. And they have additional dialogue in the definitive edition that they were able to get the Japanese voice actors back for, but they weren't able to get the English voice actors for. So when they tried to redub the new dialogue for the English version, it sounds weird and disjointed. There are many games that try to do this to make, you know, remakes or definitive versions and try to add new stuff that, like, feel like odd appendages. That you're like, oh, wait, this is just a new thing. It sounds like one of the successes of Nier Replicant isn't so much that it's one specific moment, but more like, oh, this is the tone of this game, that they have nailed what that game felt like back in the day and were able to replicate it perfectly. I think...
Yeah, more their approach and the excellence of their execution than specific moments, it seems like.
Right. Mm-hmm. It is quite a moment to be like, to realize that, but also that moment is mostly saved for people who have already played the previous version. And it's just more like a nice surprise. Like, I don't know. Like, I think we have given it its due in another category, personally. That's kind of where I'm leaning. But it is really cool that they were able to, like, nail that. And it sounds like they did the same thing for, like, going back and addressing the story.
So that one is a more specific moment that's not just in terms of a personal thing for me. It's just, like, they went and made this story, like, they kind of fixed the ending in a way. Like, the way that the original Nier ends and the way that this Nier Replicant initially ends is... In order to more or less give anyone here a future, like a positive future, you have to make a deal to erase your existence within the world itself, which goes and erases all your saves, everything you've collected, everything like that, while you watch various members of the side cast wake up and realize that something is wrong, something is missing, and kind of tearing up a little bit over that. What this does is, after you finish that part, it's all well and good. You just start a new game, and you get to a moment several hours later where you're watching a cutscene, and suddenly the cutscene breaks up, and things go differently. Suddenly you're playing as Kaine, which in itself is such a fantastic moment of one of the best characters finally gets her own time to be the protagonist for a bit. One thing leads to another, and you find out that Kaine is more or less... It's in a conversation with the original game, in a way, because it's her saying, hey, that moment before, where he did this selfless sacrifice of erasing himself, that was bullshit. He didn't take any input from any of us. He broke us in a way by leaving us like that. And it's more or less Kaine asserting herself and... fighting, like, the gods of this world to bring back the original protagonist in a way that feels very, like, in the process, she kind of fucks up the world even further than it already was fucked up, but it's this amazing and validating moment of, like, no, what happened here, like, the story saying, okay, this was such a selfless moment, it was selfish on the protagonist's part, and it was like almost selfish to just leave it like that. It was such an unsatisfying way to go, and it's incredible to see them take it back like this and be like, no, we're going to keep this group together because they deserve to be together, even if everything burns around them. And it's such a beautiful moment. I love it so much.
That definitely sounds like a better fit for the category to me.
Yes, absolutely. Like, I mean, I was about to be a little flippant and be like, oh, didn't they just do that in Nier Automata? But it sounds like that they are aware of, like, that moment of erasing your save file for, like, the greater good or whatever, and is trying to be, like to expand upon it in ways that hadn't been expanded upon before.
Also, no surprise that Jen, famous, don't want to erase my saver, is like, oh, changing the ending so that erasing the save was a bad idea is great. See, guys, I was totally right for fucking everyone over in Nier Automata.
Did you not erase your save in Nier Automata?
You didn't know this about me, Kimi?
Jennifer! Did you miss the entire point of the game?
Yes, is the answer. Yes. Yes, she did.
Oh my god.
It was a mistake one time. But, like, that's neither.
Jen, as she watches the world burn and die, she's like, listen, you make one mistake, and suddenly everybody's like, ooh, sleepy Jen making bad calls.
All right, you know what, I'm not going to belabor the point. Going back and addressing the story does sound like it is strong enough to, like, be in contention. I don't know if it makes necessarily top three, but we can have that conversation. Because, like, I didn't necessarily experience it, and it sounds like, Sex, you didn't either. But the passion for it is strong enough. I think we put a pin in that for now and eliminate a couple other things.
Yeah. Also, seeing Kaine and Emil have an actual moment they alluded to in the original where they just hang out by a campfire and talk about gay shit or whatever. Like, that is A++. Great that they actually added that when everyone was just like, where is this? When they briefly mentioned it during a passing by conversation in the original.
So I think we should cut that super cool suit in Metroid Dread.
Yeah, I agree. Like, it is... Like, let's talk about the moments in Metroid Dread. Okay. Metroid Dread is a pretty great game. I really loved Metroid Dread. But I think it's one of those... It's you know, better than the sum of its parts sort of thing for me for Dread. It is really cool when you see that suit. It is a shame that you basically get it for one QTE sequence and then you like do the escape sequence, which is cool. Don't get me wrong, the escape sequence is pretty fun, but. It's like, I failed the first time I did the escape sequence, and then I had to do it again, and it was like, oh, this is not as fun in some ways. I mean, that's on me. Like, escape sequences in Metroid games have always been, like, you know, the final test of, like, skill or whatever, but I think it's been better done in other Metroid games, like, you know, Fusion, you know, before then. I love the escape sequence in Fusion. That one rocks. Of course, Super Metroid has an incredible escape. And for Dread, it was really cool to be like, oh, Samus has, like, embraced her Metroid DNA and gets this, like, super cool, like, fucked up Kamen Rider-style suit, right? Like, it's
but
cool.
But it's a lot of the framing around it that I think fails it. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, the fact that the thing that triggers it is just that you're in the final boss fight and... you're about to lose, even though, of course, you were winning the whole fight. And then it's like, and then just Samus starts screaming a lot and goes Super Metroid Saiyan. And then, like, at the end of that sequence, when you get back to your ship, like, the fucking ex-Chozo shows up and is like, oh, here, let me give you my life. And it's just, it's so, the suit is cool. Controlling the suit is cool, and I think it honestly I disagree with you a little. I think it is around for about as long as it needs to be around. But all the framing and explanation around it and the narrative problems it solve are just kind of incoherent.
Yeah, like if it was throughout the entire game, like Samus struggling with like the Metroid DNA inside her, like, you know, like imagine if there were particular moments in the game in which like when she like gets the suit power ups from the Emmy or something, like you see glimpses of that super powerful suit as she like needs to like wrestle control away from it.
There were some of that, like towards the end there were moments where like she'll just do something with her hand and it's super fucked up and it's like, wait, where did that come from? What's happening here?
Yeah, but I want that moment throughout the entire game so that it actually has, like, narrative weight at the end when she gets into that stuff.
To be fair, I mean, they don't really explain this until the very end, but to be fair, every time you got a power from the Emmy, it was Metroid shit.
Yeah. Like,
I hear you.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where it's like, this, as much as they touted the story of this game being like a big conclusion, it kind of...
You can end things with a wet fart. That's a conclusion.
Yeah, but it's not a very satisfying one.
Yeah, you're right. I really prefer dry farts. Wet farts just, you're like, oh no.
Also, to be fair, Metroid, like, it has memorable characters and moments in its story, but also, like, any time they spend a significant amount of time talking about the story, it can go bad real fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, for sure.
Like, the games are much better as atmospheric, like, mood pieces rather than, like, explicit, like, stories sometimes. But, I don't know, there's, like, cool potential within Dread that they just didn't capitalize on.
But on the other hand, the other moment from Metroid Dread, which I like better, and I would push to stay, is the, I called it Samus Says We're Done Here, which is the end of the first boss fight. And it's a tone and an attitude to Samus you see through multiple fights in this game. But it is, I honestly think of all games that I, like literally all games, it is the best representation I've ever seen of a character who is like a true veteran, just like used to combat situations and just has an understanding, right? Because you're fighting this like stupid lizard chameleon that can turn invisible and shit, whatever. And you win the fight and it cuts to like a, you know, like end of the boss fight cutscene. And you know that you've played enough games. You know what this looks like. Samus also knows what this looks like. Samus sees the way this creature is animating and is like, oh, okay, this is Death Throes animations. Got it. And her entire behavior changes. She sort of like relaxes, and it relaxes into that kind of like, you know, it's like a gunslinger with like the gun at their gun at their side and their hand hovering near it, but they're still like kind of like relaxed shoulders, right? Of like, okay, I'm ready to take action when I need to, but I can take a breath here. This is over. We're done. And that characterization of Samus is the strongest, like, narrative writing thing they do in that entire game, is the way they portray Samus as someone who has just done this so many times that she always knows when she's in danger, when she's not, and always feels in control.
Yeah, it is really cool how much care and attention they put into the either the mocap or just the animation of Samus in general. They did imbue her with, like, a lot of character that previous games, previous games have not really had a chance to explore. So it is really cool to see that there. Yeah. I mean, I liked it. Like, I still really like Metroid Dread. It's still, like, a really good game. I just felt like it needed a few more moments like that. But, like, that moment of fighting the first boss and, like, just how she is just so totally in control. Because she's faced bigger and badder monsters, like, in her past. And is, like, I think, like, similar to that, it's more like the scene in which you find Kraid again. And she just has this, like, there's this body language that she has where it's not fear, it's not surprise, it's just, oh, this motherfucker again.
And yeah, because, like, the start of the cutscene, it's like Kraid is behind her, he doesn't see her, and she spins around, like, very alert, very ready to fight, and, like, just reacting to the motion, right? And then she spots the limit of his motion because he's chained up, and she starts to relax. And then she sees who it is, and she is just like standing like inches away from being like slashed in half, just like, are we doing this again?
Or just like, hey, buddy, right? It's like, oh, round two. Okay.
I mean, round four, really, but yeah.
Sure, sure. Well, wait a minute, hold on. She fights created super.
And in original.
Right, right. Original super.
And I think in Other M. But I'm not positive about that.
I think so, but Other M is such a fraught thing that I don't even like. Yeah. I don't like thinking about Other M. They ruin Nightmare in Other M. Okay, let's move on.
Yep.
Okay. Do I need to get rid of, like, my one mechanical moment on this list still so that we can move this along?
I'm sorry. I like that mechanic. I wouldn't support it on the list we have right now.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay, I just want to talk about shielding and Melty Blood type Lumina. It's fucking cool. Like, shielding solves a lot of interesting defensive problems, but is just, like, the moment of when you watch two competitors, or be a competitor yourself, just, like, read each other on such a level that they are just bringing up shield after shield and just figuring out each other. It's an awesome mechanic because, like, when you shield in this game, if the opponent hits your shield, you can hit one of, like, three or four button combinations. It's like A, B, or B, C, or something like that. And it gives you a different result. One is, like, you teleport behind your opponent. The other is just you do, like, a heavy attack. And it has, like, an interesting little condensed, like, rock, paper, scissors mechanic built into that one particular moment. And it's just really cool to see two people who are at the same level just go at it and, like, the shield popping up. And it makes a really satisfying noise sound when someone hits it. And it's, like, cool to see that back and forth. It is, like, it's kind of like the ideal of, like, when you're watching, like, a martial arts movie and you see two, like, fighters just, like, counter each other's counter, and they are just, like, one step of it. They're not necessarily one step ahead of each other. They're just at that same level, and they are just trying to find an opening. And I think, like, shielding in type Lumina is conducive to that type of moment that I love.
And if I have a criticism of it, it's that it's too universal. It's that I would find it more engaging if some characters had unique options out of shielding, but everyone just has the exact same options, and I think it makes it doesn't make it stale, but it makes it a little less exciting to me, a little less dynamic.
Sure. But no, I think like, just generally from, like, an accessibility point of view, like, shields solve a lot of interesting problems, and I just think it's cool. I don't know. It's like, it's a little bit more dynamic than, like, the shields in Uniclear. But, like, it is just really cool to fucking, like, block, like, not just block, but, like, pull up the shield, teleport behind someone, hit a button, and just start a, like, a full combo. It's really great. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
I think Berlin is top three, if not the winner, from Hitman 3.
Yeah, I think you're right. Berlin is a level in Hitman 3. And it is truly unlike any other Hitman level that's ever existed. I mean, it stands out more, I think, in the way they've reframed three things since Hitman 2016. Because they added, you know, they added things like Instinct, right? Which is, you know, your Hitman vision, basically, where you can see your targets and things. And they added, like, opportunities or mission stories, depending on which one you're in, where it's like, oh, hey, here's like a chain of events that the game will guide you to that will complete missions. And there's unique, you know, like, narrative to go along with it. And in Hitman 3, Berlin is the first time that you are not given a briefing on your target. You didn't come here on purpose, basically, right? You are on the run and you stumble into a situation where you are going to a club in Berlin. And there are a bunch of people here who are from the agency that you used to work for that are trying to kill you. and they're all undercover. And so if you hit your Hitman vision, you just see normal people everywhere. And your job is to go about the level and, like, look for people acting weirdly and sidle up to them and listen to their conversation and figure out who is an undercover agent trying to take you down and take them down first. And you have to do it to multiple people. Mm-hmm. And also there's the running thing, because you've tapped into their, like, their external communications, right? They're sort of their walkie, if you will. And you get so much of their inner dialogue in a way that is really interesting. You get to hear their handler slowly realize what is going on and panic. I can't remember exactly how many of them there are. I'm going to use numbers, and these numbers are not going to be accurate, but they'll be close, right? I'm going to say there are 9 of them, and you have to take out 3 of them to win, right? Let's use that as an example. You don't have to stop at 3. At 3, they will start to leave, but you cannot let them leave. And the situation develops and changes, and the handler for these agents really gets distressed if you start going over the necessary kill count, where, like, you can kill every one of these agents and she's just like, oh god fucking damn it, oh I'm so upset. There's just a lot of really great dialogue and interactions, but also mechanically this level is fascinating.
Yeah, and it's also worth pointing out that, like, I feel like Berlin is the last type of level anyone expected IO to make after what happened with Absolution. Like, Hitman Absolution was a game that kind of killed the franchise for a while and almost killed IO themselves. And when they brought back Hitman in 2016, they went back to basics. They were like, okay, we're going to create a level, give you a bunch of opportunities to learn it, and take out things your way. Like, getting very close to how it was in Blood Money or games older than that.
Like, but the platonic ideal of a Hitman game was realized in the World of Assassination trilogy in some ways.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And with Hitman 3, especially in the back half of the levels we see here, Hitman 3 is IO finally regaining their confidence and being like, we can fucking do one of these levels again. We can just take a level, present it in a way that is completely unfamiliar to the audience, and, like, do something that is trying to be played in a specific way and make it work. And not only did they manage to do that in a way that Absolution failed at, they also made, like, the perfect video game version of something like a Jason Bourne film. And I've never seen any other game, Hitman or otherwise, nail it as well as this level did, of being on the run, finding an environment that you can work with, and turning the tables on your pursuers.
There's just this great, like, sense you get in this level where, like, again, I'm going to use a fake example, but let's say one of the agents' name is Agent Carlton, right? Mm-hmm. And you are standing, like, 10 feet away from Agent Carlton. You've tapped into his comms, and he's, like, the handler's like, Agent Carlton, what's the status? And he's like, well, oh, there's nothing here. Just hanging out at the bar, getting kind of annoyed, blah, blah, blah. And then he stops, and then Agent 47 just whispers to himself, Agent Carlton. And then he pops up on Hitman Vision from now on. It's just like, he's gonna fucking, you can watch mechanically 47 decide to kill someone. It's incredible.
It sounds, honestly, the way this level is put together, the way it sounds like to me they're gonna do a really fucking good job with that James Bond game.
Yeah. I'm starting to lean towards, I don't know if you two will feel this way, I'm starting to lean towards things that are both great narrative and also great mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Which makes me want to remove the Samus Says We're Done Here.
Yeah, same. It's really cool to see them put a level of care and attention into the animation, but ultimately that's kind of what it is. There's that. Let's see. So how many do we have left? We have one.
We have
go ahead.
5 right now?
Yep, we have 5.
So we need to either cut to or expand. Let's talk about Titania, Queen of Fairies. I have not played Code Fairy, so I want to hear the argument for Titania.
Okay. So, you have watched Gundam. You're aware of how Gundam work in way. Gundam work in way. Whew, great. I love words. You are, for most of Code Fairy, you are playing as Alma Sterner, who is a young ace pilot for Zeon. And you're piloting a modified Zaku. And there comes a point where basically, like, you start to outgrow the Zaku, right? It's like happens to Amuro in 0079. Your reaction times are getting too fast for the Zaku to keep up with. And your boss manages to pull some strings, is like, okay, listen, I'll get you a new suit. And that suit gets sent to Earth, and you have to sort of like change plans on a mission to pick it up because it drops in enemy territory in a way it wasn't planned to, and you have to fight to get it. And then you pull it out, and it is just a frame. There's no armor. There are no thrusters. There's no weapons. And so there's the first layer of disappointment of like, oh, okay, so I can't actually pilot this right now. You're going to need to do some work to it. And then you have the cutscene where you are talking to the head of engineering, the head mechanic, and your commander. And the head of engineering is like, I am not making this blueprint. This blueprint is for a suicide weapon. It is really fast. It has decent armaments. It has no fucking armor. Alma, if you pilot this, you will fucking die. And almost like, you give me that fucking robot. You give me that robot right fucking now. Like, nuh-uh, I'm not going to do it. And there's sort of this like consolation of like, don't worry, we'll figure something out, Alma. We'll definitely figure something out. And it's just sort of like it is very much like when you don't get the Christmas present you want and your parents say there's always next year and you're like, shut the fuck up. this is nothing. You are just saying words. We both know this is bullshit. I'm not an ungrateful gift receiver, but we also know the sentiment.
Yeah.
And then finally, at the end of chapter 2, volume 2, I should say, chapter 10, the Titania is done. And you take it for a spin, and it is just at the right time, of course, narratively, for you to have a big showdown against your rival, who you fought at the end of volume 1, and it was basically all you could do to stall them. They put you in a coma. And now you are fighting them on even territory. You are in a machine that is sick as hell. The Titania is so fucking cool. It is incredibly fun to pilot, and Alma as a character, but also you as a player, feel the moment of like, oh yeah, no, that machine was holding me back. I actually am like, I am more capable of this, and my skill has grown more than I thought. It's just it's an incredible mission. It's an incredible moment, and it's fun as shit.
Yeah, it's a great highlight in a great game.
Okay. That sounds awesome. I really like that. I think for the sake of us moving along, we might have to make some cuts. Lady Dimitrescu moment probably goes, because that's like a really fun narrative thing. But if we are, like, it sounds like for this year, we really want to like focus in on like, go ahead.
Let me make a counter proposal. I do think overall we want to focus in more on the mechanical, but I don't want to focus so hard that we close our eyes to other possibilities. I think we cut near an inscription.
Wow. Okay.
And
listen, it's your baby and it's my baby, Jen. I'm not just being mean here.
I think I could see the argument for cutting, replacing your eye in inscription, because it sounds like that game is just so full of like moments that like no one moment can really encapsulate it. In inscription is definitely just one of those things that is just super worth your time in playing. but like it's less of a super singular moment that works here. And
with Nier, I feel like, I mean, I know this is gonna sound a little manipulative of me. I apologize, but I do think it's a situation where what that thing does, what that remaster and to a degree reimagining does, I don't think you can boil it down to a moment. I just don't think that captures it. You know, I think the thing that it does so well is it's our welcome back. It's our best remaster. It's our best return of a game in 2021.
Like it's one of those things where it's like, if you just, I think it's one of those moments where it's like, if you just told someone about the ending of Nier Replicant, I mean, when you first told me, it was like, oh, that's just Nier Automata again. And then there's some modifiers there. But obviously it requires me having a, like, holistic understanding of that game. And I think it's not so much that that moment isn't good. It's more like you need to have understood the entire game to get there. Like, is that the argument that I'm picking up on?
Yeah, I mean, like, this year we didn't do a best story, and I'm glad, because I would be sitting here very grouchily admitting that Nier Replicant gets Story of the Year. I would not want to give it that award, but I would have to. But, like, I just think in best moment, which is kind of about as like a slice you can take out and show someone and they'll be like, fuck yeah, I don't think in that way is how it shines.
Like, it definitely sounds like I should put Nier Replicant and other, like, of those games, like, back on my, like, to-do list.
Oh, yeah. You should definitely play it.
Yeah. But it's more like, this sounds like this is a game of, which is like, it's a collection of moments, much like Inscription. Like, we're not cutting it because it's bad, but mostly because, like, in the spirit of the category, we are trying to, like, focus in on, like, just those singular moments that you can just slice out, hand it to people, and they'll instantly understand the appeal of the game.
Okay. And, yeah, in that case... Go ahead.
And my personal motive here is, like, one, whenever possible, I want to make it a top three. I think the possibility, leaving open the door to doing more is good, but I think it is also good to force ourselves to make those hard choices and to really get analytical rather than, you know, just sort of cop out and say, like, well, you're all games of the year in my heart. So I want to try and make us do a top three when possible. And I really have a hard time imagining this list without what we would probably cut in favor of it, which is the Lady Dimitrescu a hand moment, which is just the funniest fucking shit.
It is so fucking funny. Like, I mean, I was mostly, I guess, like, leaning towards that way because of, like, you know, just point of order or whatever, but, like, that moment is just so great. It captures the tone of Resi Evil 8 perfectly as this goofy-ass thing where it's just, every moment of it works. It's like, you lose your ability to use a weapon for that particular time. You gotta juke around Lady Dimitrescu as she's chasing you down this hallway, and you're just, like, trying to be like, oh man, I lost my hand. Is this gonna be for the rest of the game? But no. Ethan just pulls out a goddamn, like vial of goop, puts it over his hand, and reattaches it, and makes a snide remark.
Yeah.
Like, it perfectly capped, like, if that moment was in a Sam Raimi movie, that would fit, like, super well.
Yeah, and there is something to be said about the collective experience of watching everyone else go through that moment on Twitter and on YouTube and stuff, like, getting to the bit that was like, oh god, my hand, and then it's like, as 5 minutes later, just seeing them go, oh shit. Yeah.
The moment where he doubles back to pick up his hand, I was like, what are you doing? Why do you care? And I'm like, what?
The moment that the hand gets into your inventory is also really fucking funny because it shows up as a key item in your inventory.
Yeah. See, that for me, like, they also did that in RE7, so that wasn't... That part was like, oh, okay. But the attachment part, that was the moment that just sold me super hard.
Yeah, that's the moment when you realize, like, that game is going to do something for you in a really fun way.
Okay.
But yeah, I think we can lose Nier, and I think this will be a top three. And it sounds like Berlin is the winner.
Yeah, Berlin's the winner, hands down.
Yeah, Berlin's the winner.
like no fucking contest. Like, it really encapsulates, like, it is an incredible narrative moment and mechanical moment, and it has lots of really cool things. Like, it's so cool to be like, you're right, like, going into a scenario and you don't know your target, and you actually have to act like, I always love it when a game forces you to think like its characters, and you have to think like, well, a hitman, not just like, oh, I'm checking off this list. It's like, oh, I have to, like, observe my surroundings and observe the people in the environment to get there. That's really fucking cool.
Yeah, and it's also a redemption arc for IO Interactive itself. Like, before Absolution, like, even in that state, they had a bunch of hits and misses, but even their hits had this kind of uncomfortable tone to it. But, like, the entire Hitman trilogy has this just been them, like, getting born anew and showing, no, we know our shit now, we are IO Interactive, we're here to stay, and it's so fucking great.
Yeah, the world
of... If you want to see this level for yourself, there is a great, like, cinematically edited video of someone doing basically one of the, like, they're not labeled as opportunities, but basically doing an opportunity on that map and setting up so they kill every agent on the map at the same time. And it is incredible.
Oh, I need to see that. You need to send me a link after this.
Sick.
Yeah, no, it's, I think we can declare a winner here, hands down.
All right, congratulations to the Berlin level from Hitman 3, our best moment presented by Final Fantasy XIV Endwalker, with runners-up giving Lady Dimitrescu a hand, and then, I guess, taking it back from Resident Evil Village, and Titania, Queen of Fairies, from Mobile Suit Gundam Battle Operation 2 Code Fairy. I look forward to never saying Mobile Suit Gundam Battle Operation 2 Code Fairy on a podcast ever again. That's a long and annoying name.
Oh, okay. So, guess you're not going to put it on the best game list then.
No, I like it a lot, but I don't think I would push for it in GOTY. Anyway, thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. We will catch you with more awards. Actually, at this point, I think more award? I think this might be the second to last one to go up.
We'll see.
Anyway, peace out, everybody.
See ya.
Later.